businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 181 of the Killing It Podcast. Dave showed up with a cold. I have allergies. What do you got going on, Ryan?
It's just a real cold, too. I tested, I swear.
I swear, it's only a cold. I am broadcasting live or on podcast recording from the great country of Scotland. And if you've never been, I will be the Chamber of Commerce for the entire country of Scotland. And I will tell you 11 reasons why you cannot not come to this place. It is absolutely spectacular.
It's a good country.
Love me Scotland in August. That's the only time the weather is good.
All right, gents.
Actually, we've had 68 degrees and sunshine. So
there you go.
Wow, that is very un-Scottish. You get that is very, very un-Scottish. All right, gents. What smell brings back great memories?
Ooh. So for me, well, almost I have so many things from my mom's cooking when I was young, but apple pie. Which is funny because I don't eat that much apple pie, but I sure love the smell of it.
Mm-hmm. See, I think that's an important thing. Whether or not it actually tastes good or whether it was your favorite thing, smells have a different impact, different psychological impact on you. I go back to homemade pasta, right? The homemade pasta sauce was phenomenal. I would prefer to eat that, but there is something about the smell of making pasta at home. My mom used to do it when I was little, and that is a thing that if you happen to go to a restaurant and they make their own on site, you can tell.
You guys are so mature with your answers. I'm gonna go like so immature. Cheap beer, like stale cheap beer, takes me back to some college days and just like lots, like carefree, lots less responsibility. There's this that just really bad beer will really take me back to being young and
see,
a lot dumber.
See, that's the thing, right? It's stuff you wouldn't actually drink right now if somebody gave it to you for free. But the smell of it takes you back to the
glory. I have to say, the smell, when you say those words, that smell is very clear in my head. I'm not sure it is associated with positive things, though.
I wasn't a drinker in college until my senior year, actually. And so, like, but it's the association with the good times and hanging out in lots of fun places.
I will
places.
Say, one of the things that we don't get much of today is actual beer-flavored beer. Right. My dad drank beer. He didn't drink a lager or a pilsner or you know, whatever. He drank beer. And so if you get like a Red Stripe, that's got a smell and a taste that is quite distinct from all of the fancy dancy beers.
See, I'm holding myself back. This is a whole other podcast.
I know. I was going to say Red Stripe just smells like
vacation. All right. Listeners should be doing all beer podcasts because this may have to be a bonus episode. Is distinctly breaking with the format.
We can do a Killing It Live with beer.
With beer. Do you know about Nodeware? Nodeware is an in-demand and real-time cybersecurity solution that helps businesses reduce the risk of ransomware or other cyber attacks, all with breakthrough simplicity and affordability. With truly continuous vulnerability scanning, even during normal business hours, you'll get real-time alerts of network access and newfound risks with easy and insightful reports to take action on and report to your customers. Want to learn more? Visit nodeware.com/partners to find out more. So I will kick us off with a data survey, and I'm going to quote right from the piece. A new survey of over 500 IT decision makers at small and medium businesses from threat detection and response specialist Vade shows 69% say a serious breach had bypassed their current email security solution. It's perhaps not surprising that the SMBs are increasingly likely to turn to managed services providers, with 96% of organizations either currently outsourcing or at least some of their needs to MSPs or planning to do so in the future. Gents, what's your reaction to this piece of research?
My first reaction is bullshit. And let me explain why that is my first reaction. 96% of SMB organizations either are already paying an MSP or are planning to pay an MSP for at least a portion of their cybersecurity management services. The latest and greatest research that I can get my hands on indicates that the total penetration of managed security services into the SMB space is somewhere barely north of 10% of the SMB marketplace. If 96% of people tell me I am either already outsourcing my managed services for security or I intend to do so soon, my answer is, okay, so that was the public response that everybody wanted to hear. Now tell me what you're actually going to do, because MSPs around the world, if this was actually true, you couldn't possibly grow your business fast enough to keep up with that kind of market demand.
Wow. All right. You went right for it, Ryan. And so I'm gonna weigh in then next, because I'm a data nerd. Anybody who listens to Business Tech knows that, like, I have spent so much of my time quoting surveys like this. There's a reason I always include who did the survey and which company sponsored it, because I do believe that there is insights to be gained from these kinds of surveys, but you've got to put on your critical thinking hat to understand, well, why did they do this survey? What are they trying to sell? What's the end goal to that? My takeaway here is much more around the, yeah, these email security solutions are bypassed by people. Like, that literally is what I was, what I immediately went to. And I immediately also went the same place you did, Ryan. I was, oh, yeah. They're just trying to tell you that, like, outsourcers do this so that, you know, they lump together a bunch of the survey questions to get something that says you should sell this thing. You pull out the insight that is useful, which is the, like, oh, the breaches are happening even despite the current security email solution. That's what I take away from this one, and we should be looking with a critical eye of maybe that alone isn't going to do it, or maybe that's not the total solution to the problem. That's the insight that I get from the survey. It's probably not what the vendor wanted, but, you know.
But it's perfectly fair.
Right. And so I'm very critical, as one who cites all of these things all the time, I'm very critical of understanding, well, why did this survey go into market?
One of the things that I thought was interesting was that 87% of the people who are decision makers said we could be doing more. And I'm wondering, so the other half of that equation is, so why aren't you? And 80% say that their, you know, the built-in security systems, like for their email, are not strong enough. And they know that. And so the question is, why aren't they spending more, right? And whether it's because this was put together by a security vendor or not, those are legitimate questions. And so I think the important thing that's sort of not stated in this article, which is about 15 pages, the thing that's not stated is, how do you have a conversation that's honest with these decision makers? Because they know they need more, they will not buy more, they have not bought into the more. And every time you come and talk to them about more, they say, well, that just costs money. And they need to have a conversation about what it costs them to be insecure. We don't want to sell on fear, but the reality is 69% have been breached despite what they've done so far. They do need to do more, and they can't avoid that conversation.
Well, and see, I think, again, to take this, Dave, where you were going, to put a positive spin on it from a vendor's point of view. I've spent a ton of time looking inside of these tools across the cybersecurity space, and I am sincerely impressed with the capabilities of these detect and respond kinds of technologies. I have multiple vendors, different pieces of software that you can use. I've been in it for 25 years. I sincerely am impressed by what this software can do. But to your point, Carl, a tool by itself does nothing. It needs continuous monitoring, proper patching, all the configuration, all the always on evergreen approaches to the administration of this stuff. It is not a question of what the tool can do. It is a question of how you persuade the customer to give money in return for improved security. In other words, and again, this is a record I have been scratching for a couple of years here. It is not a question of whether or not the technology is good enough. It's a question of whether or not we know how to sell it as an industry. And I think the observation here, to your point, Carl, the observation is we don't know how to sell it. We have tools that are great. We have customers that are in desperate need. 1+1 ought to equal ever increasing consumption. If it doesn't, then the problem is not the software and the problem is not the customer's urgency. The problem is our ability to connect the dots in a persuasive sales process in between. That's where we're at.
Maybe. I want to push back a little bit, and I think this is not all spend is equal. Like, look, I did an editorial that I got a lot of pushback on where I call it IT security attacks, right? The reason is nobody wants to buy this stuff. If I'm owning a business, I do not want to spend money here. It does not make me any money. And I think it's the reason I put this premise out is back to the statement around being realistic around spend. I do think you want to separate out the different kinds of spend and why you spend money on technology. Some of it should be spent to grow top line revenue. That's the best in my good, better, best model. Because you need to do that. And if you can get that money, you might be able to get some of the money to do security of that because some of the investment is. But oftentimes, it all gets lumped into the same bucket. And then that the expense portion of it drags the whole pile down. And so it's not useful to view all of this stuff as equal. And it's not just a generic, we can't sell it problem. It's oftentimes you're not positioning the spend effectively against the business goals, and you got to be doing
well,
that.
And I agree with that because I have to say, every time you ask people about what's ABC, the money piece of it comes in low. In this survey, it's in the 20%, 23-27% say that cost is the major factor in why, you know, what they're challenged with. The reality is they don't understand this stuff enough to buy it, and that's the MSP's fault. So even though they say, I'm not buying it because of money, that's not why they're not buying it. And you need to get under the hood and find out why they're really not buying it, because they're never going to understand it. So if you want to learn how to sell security, you have to learn why they're not buying. And that's not an easy answer.
No, because nobody wants to buy it.
I know, Dave, I'll wrap it up with a quick observation. You said the magic word in there. You have to position it as a business outcome, not as a tool that is a tax on your expense line items. What you just said was a very compelling professional way of saying sales.
Right. Sadly, that's it for this topic. Topic number two today, California has passed and is waiting for the governor to sign something called the Age Appropriate Design Code Act, which is to say they are forcing people who write code, people who write programs intended for consumption by children, that they need to have some safeguards in place. All wonderful, delightful, good news. And we pointed to a couple of articles about that, primarily one from Wired magazine. So the goal here is to say, look, don't put ads, don't put inappropriate images in front of children, right? All of that is good stuff. The problem is, in my opinion, that they also have attached it to an inability to actually enforce the law. The fines are $7,500 per affected students. So that means, let's say that 10 million students are affected. That's a $7.5 billion fine for one incident. Either there's only like two companies on earth who can afford that, or they just take all of their money and put it into fighting the law instead of enforcing it. And I just think it's sort of like good intention combined with just plain stupidity when it comes to enforcement. I think it's better to say, hey, Facebook and Google and whoever is writing this stuff, YouTube, if you're going to have children involved, let's agree on some guidelines. And I'd much rather see us get together with a bunch of these folks and say, what can we as an industry do, rather than have the government just say, here's some rules and we'll fine you out of business if you break them.
All right. I want to push back because, Carl, that's not what it says. Right. But that's because it's not what it says. And we quote, I'm quoting the article. If a company violates the law, they have 90 days to come up with a fix, or the California Attorney General's office could extract a fine of up to $7,500 per affected child. That's a different statement than saying it's a $7,500 fine. In fact, it is a much more nuanced statement. It is saying the, look, we found a problem. We are now asking you, industry, to fix it. We can approve the fix, and then there's no fine. And we have leeway anywhere from zero to $7,500 on that. It's much more nuanced than that. And it's real. I'm on the different side of this than you on this, but I'm pushing back saying, like, we need to be a little bit more trusting of some of the very smart people that are in public service, saying, like, look, we're giving them some parameters, we're giving them some tools. Let's actually then empower them to work with these companies and then be responsive. There's a process.
I would also point out, you live in a very different state with a very different attorney general.
Well, okay, but by the way, this is why you dig into who you vote for and like and what an attorney general matters. I mean, I get all of that, but I'm also looking and saying, like, there's a lot of innovation coming out of California, right? like there's a lot of that stuff, even with a regulatory environment. I think it's easy to go, it's a $7,500 fine every single time. It will immediately drive them out of business. Now, there's this whole range in the middle, right? And do I think that, I mean, would I rather that be like a Virginia attorney general be working on that? Probably, because they tend to be a little bit more pro-business than they find it. But the intention of the way the law is written is to give this space. I hear what you're saying, right? Like, and I can see it easily being abused. But by the way, there is a space here for it to work with industry as written. Well,
and again, I will say to put your two points together, very good intention, very appropriate topic to be focused on. Perhaps not the most effective execution of the intention, but it is focused on something very real and substantial. I want to put a little scope to this, right? If you think about what has happened in the world of education, especially in the K-12 marketplace in the last 2.5 years, as we've gone remote, pandemic, all of this digital learning, the technology industry has spent 2.5 years selling quite literally every speck of silicon that we could find anywhere on the planet in the form of a student device to get a computer, some kind of an interactive digital device into the hands of every single student we possibly could. Now, we've discussed at length on this program before, we're not done. We don't nearly have every child with all of that capability. But the one thing that has become glaringly obvious in that process is that most of those things sit idle most of the time because there is no content. Now, if you tell me that there is now a brand new marketplace of 10, 20, 30, 50 million student devices that have been thrown out there into the world, and now everybody with government funding happened to look at that and went, oh, wait a minute, we don't have any software, we don't have any curriculum, any actual content to fill or utilize those devices, .. we're going to start throwing money at the industry, and you know we're going to have a problem with content. You know we're going to get things in there that is inappropriate, things that are not age specific. We're going to create a problem. Now, this is the first time that I can legitimately say that we look at government, whether they did it well or not well. We've spent 3 years on this podcast telling people, you know, you might want to, like, I don't know, educate a legislator on things like email and things like spam and things like ransomware, because they literally are years behind the curve. This is a time where a massive regulatory body is actually on the power curve. Like, they're regulating content for student curriculum at the time when that is absolutely mission critical. I agree. I think it is totally ham-fisted, and it'll never actually have the intended effect with that great big, like, 800-pound gorilla fine that's hanging over people's head. But at least they're on the topic before it's like 40 years old news.
Well, I will tell you, my favorite analogy on something like this is always, you got a problem with your neighbor. Should you knock on the neighbor's door or call the police? And this says, call the police. Do not engage the neighbor. Do not talk to them. Do not negotiate with them. Do not prevent the problem before it happens. Let's just call the police and get out the big hammer. And I don't know, again, other states may act differently. Around here, what this means is you charge them with the highest fine possible and you negotiate down from there. And so I just think it's absurd. And I think the good news is we'll regulate the hell out of it and make it unenforceable anyway. So there's always that.
You may end up in that space, but I'm gonna soapbox for a moment with this. Is I really want to have a spirit though of a lot of people in public service get really dumped on inappropriately, and I'm coming off of, I mean, I was just on vacation and visiting a friend abroad who's working in the U.S. Embassy abroad. And if you want to see an amazing logistics operation and you want to see a bunch of people doing really good work abroad, go talk to people that work in embassies, because they are on their frigging game in terms of running services for Americans abroad. And you look at those, you get firsthand experience with people that are doing good work. And oftentimes it's real easy to be dismissive of all of this without looking at there are a lot of organizations that are doing really good work. And I just want to make sure that we are not immediately jumping to it's always bad. Yes, we should be absolutely looking at it. Carl, do I think that this is going to go smoothly? No, absolutely I don't. But I also want to take it from a spirit of, I think the people enacting this have the right idea. They've built a framework, and it's going to iterate a whole bunch of times. And by the way, protecting children seems to be something these businesses are not doing on their own. So maybe we do want to have some of this
final word on this. I'll just say we have too many laws in place where people said, hey, you know, who could possibly be against, you know, mothers against drunk drivers, who could possibly want to defend attacking children, da 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 da. So any law that we pass and we have that as our excuse, we get to pass the law no matter how bad it is. So sadly, we're out of time.
Maybe. Exactly. We'll move on from that one, the concept of good intentions that might need some refining. Our next topic, we're going to talk about some bad intentions that really, really need to have some attention put on them. So we link to an article in the show notes, and I would highly encourage everybody to actually click and read on this one, because there was a moment in the middle of reading this article that I had a visceral reaction of just, not just disbelief, but honest to goodness anger at the fact that people think that this is okay. So give you a little context on this thing. We're talking about the idea of data tracking for identification purposes linked to a unique device ID for advertising purposes that is then aggregated and sold on subscription to police departments around the country for the purpose of saying, I don't know who you are, I don't know what you've done, but based on my subscription, I can track everywhere you go, everything you do, not just today, and not just with the benefit of a warrant that is compliant with the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, but I can go back 3 years in time, I can track you in real time, and use that for a warrantless search to identify without the burden of probable cause. Now, we've talked on this program at length about the fact that all this tracking and identification data might be scary because it might at some point get used in nefarious ways. Guys, it's not a might anymore. This is happening in the real world, and I'd love to know, what in the hell do we actually do about this?
You mean there's a privacy law making its way through Congress? Maybe, just maybe, we look at actually defining some of this. What a novel idea.
So I've mentioned this before, but this often happens with technology, is that the technology's out there, the law enforcement figures out how to use it, and they're just one step ahead of regulation that says, no, you can't use it that way, or you should use it this way. And this is just like, I mean, some smart law enforcement officer looked at this and said, hey, big data, we can track a pattern of people who do this and this and this and this and this. And it's like predicting, oh, they're going to shoplift. This is, it's not quite final verdict, but it'll do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and look, I mean, it's, you know, I'm on my soapbox yet again. I'm on my soapbox, but this is the element of like, I always look for what's the warrant structure around this. And the fact that they don't need a warrant to get this tells me, well, it's legal, right? It's going to, they are reasonably confident that there are some lawyers at this that have figured out that they can get away with this. And that's why we would want to have some level of definition of what the expectation of privacy is in order for that to fall under the area where they have to get a warrant. We actually do have systems for this. Carl, you're right. If the laws, if they're ahead of the laws, well, we actually should define this stuff if we're interested in having that level of privacy. I actually, while I bristle and I don't like law enforcement doing this, I am looking going, well, they're not, it does not appear to be illegal.
Well,
perhaps we should fix that.
So some of that comes down to, again, I'd love before the law gets involved for them to have a conversation amongst themselves and say, you know, it's sort of like when you do research, it may or may not be legal to do a certain kind of research involving certain kind of questions with certain kinds of audiences. But universities have research panels, and you take it to the ethics panel, and they say, yes, you can, or no, you should not do this kind of research. You can discuss the ethics of something separate from whether or not it's legal, and you can look at the bigger picture and say, is it in the interest of law enforcement to engage in this behavior, which hasn't been determined to violate the Fourth Amendment, but it might violate the spirit of the Fourth Amendment, right? So why don't we regulate ourselves before somebody else steps in and says, no, thou shalt not?
Yeah, see, that's the problem, right? Because to kind of dig in a little bit deeper, the reason that they are able to do this and not run afoul of the law is that it is positioned as anonymized data, right? Like that ad ID that's associated with your device, if they take your name off of that, then it's not giving away anybody's personal information, but if I allow you to see a 3-year pattern of where that device went from, and I know where you go in the mornings and the afternoons and the nights, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to attach a name back to that anonymized record. And that is the reason actually for the expose that we're referring to, is that they're saying you're splitting hairs in order to stay nominally legal here, but the ethics of it indicate that it is grossly in violation of the intention of you shouldn't be able to go back in time and identify people's patterns of life without probable cause. That's literally the definition of the Fourth Amendment. The problem here is the advocacy and the intention, right? Like the use cases that they're talking about in this article are, well, you know, in exigent circumstances, we don't have time to get a warrant. We need to bust down the door and solve the problem. Apply that to privacy data. And if there's something bad about to happen, well, we can't wait for the legal loopholes. We need to make sure that we get in there and stop the problem. Except that when you read the article, and I know I promised you guys I wasn't going to make a reference to this movie again on one of our podcasts, but I swear to God, you read the definition of this in this article, and my reaction was, dude, you literally just said pre-crime. You literally just said Minority Report, pre-crime, and you're doing it with machine learning instead of some glowing people in a vat of liquid. But that's literally what you're doing, is predictive analysis to identify what's about to go wrong, instead of just trying to identify the suspects of a crime already committed. That part freaks me out.
Well, it should. like that's...
And I apologize for the Minority Report.
I also put a link in the show notes to data.gov, 335,000 government databases available for you to use whenever you want, for whatever you want. And, you know, I get that there are people who are well-intentioned who just want to do their job and they want to find a better way of doing this. And to be honest, we have a real need in our society, right? I mean, more and more we're hearing, hey, you know, we should be able to prevent gun violence by having some idea of who the people are that are about to go over the edge. So this is the kind of thing that would help you find that behavior. But then it still comes down to, but we still have a Bill of Rights. And so, you know, how do you draw that line? Because there's a legit need to figure out some of this, But then the other question is it the law enforcement agency that should be doing this, or maybe a mental health agency that should be doing this? Who can legitimately use this sort of procedure? And I just think we need to have a public discussion about that before we say, go ahead, do whatever the hell you want.
Well, I would 100% agree with that. I mean, that is the point of this. And in fact, I mean, you know, I wear it on my sleeve. Like, I believe in investing more in this. You've literally, should we be separating out some of this into mental health services as a different from law enforcement? You know, can we get other services available? That's some of the answers. And we get into all those societal questions that come along with that. And we don't have time for them.
Sadly, the world is very complicated.
Yeah, see, and this is the thing. The reason we have all three of our voices on here is that I can freak out, and then Carl can actually have a valid, reasonable response about how to proceed on this thing, because that suggestion about getting it into the right hands of the right people who could do preventative and not punishment things, that's actually a very tangible solution, and it makes a whole lot of sense. So I feel like that's progress.
And that's all the progress we have for today. Thank you for listening to episode 181 of the Killing It.
Killing It.
Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It Podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.